Hi everyone, and welcome back to the Alchemy of Life podcast with me, Steffi White. Today's guest is the wonderful Jared Kite, and for me this conversation was so special. Jared was there to support me through my darkest hours, and he was a real lighthouse. His treatments were pivotal in bringing me back home to self. The heart and soul of this conversation is really what I feel that we need to all hear and embody. It is filled with wisdom. So sit back and enjoy. Jared Kite is a five elements master acupuncturist and psychotherapist with more than 25 years of experience. He is internationally recognized as a leading practitioner in his field and a leading fertility expert. He is the author of The Art of Baby Making and Everything You Need, You Have. When I walked into Jared's clinic in 2020, I was desperate and so scared about the possibility of not having children. His treatments on me were pivotal in the journey to finding my way back home to myself. When I met Jared, I was fully subscribed to the idea that there was something deeply wrong with me. But through his treatment, Jared helped me to reclaim my power, let go of the fear, and what was not mine to control. So Jared, welcome to the Alchemy of Life podcast. It is so very special to have you here.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So for anyone who's listening who's never heard of five elements acupuncture, I would love for us to start at the very beginning. Can you tell us what exactly is five elements acupuncture and how does it work?
I mean, it is a system of medicine, as most people understand it in that way, but it is based on a philosophy, and it's Taoist philosophy. And the Taoist philosophy that was coming from ancient China was essentially looking at life and the oneness of life and how we as human beings sit within this oneness. And what the ancient Chinese very cleverly worked out is that the five elements that they experienced in the outside world and the natural laws that governed the five elements and the seasons and the way of life also operated within us. So what they saw is that nature always corrected itself. It would go in and out of balance all the time as it goes through the seasons, as different patterns of weather change and life evolves. And they saw these exact same patterns would then obviously operate within us because we are also part of nature. So the natural laws of the five elements, how the five elements create each other, they control each other, are also the way that we as human beings can self-heal, how we can return to balance when we go out of balance. So it really is quite simple. And it's based on facts. And the fact is that what we know about nature is that it always returns to balance.
I love that.
Was that succinct enough?
That was beautiful. I love that. And it's just when you're speaking there, it's just so hopeful. And it is factual, but it just gives me such hope that we're fluctuating, things are moving, like the seasons, we are nature, but ultimately we can and we will come back to this place of balance.
Yeah. And the other thing that I think is really beautiful about the philosophy is that we are one. We're all governed by the same laws. We all come from the same source. And yet we're all totally unique. And that sometimes seems like a contradiction. But it is the beauty of the system of medicine in that the natural laws that we're working with to help someone return to balance is a way for them to be the unique manifestation of life that they are. And I remember the first time when I heard that, I mean, it sounds a bit egotistical, but this idea that there has never been, never will be, and currently isn't anyone the same as me. And I think for anyone, no matter how bad they feel or whatever's going on in their life, to remember that you know, we're a one-shot deal, each of us, and that is pretty remarkable.
I love it. It's so empowering. So before becoming a five elements master acupuncturist, you were working as a psychotherapist. What was it that led you to the theory and treatment of five elements? And can you remember the first time that you experienced the treatment?
Yes, it actually started with having an acupuncture treatment. This is back in the 80s. I was living in San Francisco and I was in business. I had a travel business there. I didn't believe in any of this kind of alternative stuff, but obviously I was in San Francisco, so it was everywhere. So I was working in this travel business, and two of the guys that were working with me said, "Oh God, you're so uptight. You know, what's wrong with you? Why can't you just chill out?" Because they're kind of stroll in and out of the office. And then one day they said, "Why don't you go and see this acupuncturist down the road? He'll chill you out." So I thought, okay, I'll go along. I didn't expect anything. I mean, I sat with this guy and he's asking me all these questions. I'd never had therapy or anything. And I was, you know, in my mid-20s. And I left there. He'd done two needles, literally. And I left there and I thought, well, that's a load of rubbish. So I went back to the office, said that was a load of rubbish, stupid ideas. And then the next morning, I remember waking up, looking out the window, and I was watching the buses go by. And the people on the buses all seemed to be looking through my window at me, which was kind of bizarre. It was kind of it's kind of surreal, almost kind of druggy type experience. And I could tell that my perception had changed. Now, at the time, I didn't credit the acupuncture. I just thought this is just something really weird happening. And then it happened again in a similar way. And what I now realize, it was literally me waking up. It was me seeing things as they really are for the first time and hearing things for the first time. And I thought I was okay at that time. I clearly wasn't. And it's the comparison. And it's interesting when I'm treating people now, and a lot of people come in with a complaint like fertility or headaches or whatever, and they think they're actually okay. They just don't understand why this thing is happening or why they can't get this thing they want. And really, that's the most exciting thing about treatment, is that people literally start to wake up and they see themselves and the world differently. So that was, keep this short, but that was how I was introduced to it. And it was on the back of that I became a psychotherapist, with this new kind of insight and curiosity about human beings. It didn't occur to me to become an acupuncturist. I just thought that was too clever for me. So it was during my psychotherapy training that I then realized that I wanted to actually bring acupuncture to the people I work with, and not just a listening therapy.
And that was what really surprised me so much about the treatment, is that exactly as you said it there, this waking up. So I thought I was coming to you just with fertility issues, and that all we would do is talk about fertility and you would treat for that. But literally from the moment I met you in the first conversation that we had, it was apparent to me how much deeper this was, and that it was really about getting under the skin to the root cause of what was going on. So can you share a little bit more about that? Do you find that with your patients, they are either open to that, or do people sometimes resist? Like, I'm not here to talk about my parents, I want to get pregnant. Or do you feel that everyone kind of lands with you who needs to be with you, and they're ready for it?
My experience is that they fall into line straight away. And when I say fall into line, I mean they kind of get it straight away. Because I think what's particularly fascinating for me about this system of medicine is it addresses the spiritual aspect of the person, meaning that when we meet another human being, we meet them physically. Often we shake hands or in their physical presence. We meet them intellectually, mentally. We engage with them through our minds. But most importantly, in this tradition, we have to consciously engage with the patient or the client with spirit. What that means is to really look into someone's eyes and be totally present to them. Now, these are three levels of communication. And a lot of the time, in the West particularly, is, you know, we're meeting people with our physical body and with our mind, but we're so preoccupied with our own stuff or what they might think about us or all these complications of the mind, that stops us actually engaging with them with this feeling of oneness. And I think that when you invite someone to join you in that place, which you do by consciously offering that, they immediately get it at the spirit level. They consent, because they understand that's actually what most of us really want. And the mind then falls into line too. It goes, okay, I get this. So the primary objective is to meet as one. Then secondly, we're going to come in and we're going to talk about stuff. So that's already kind of flavored by the spirit. And then, of course, you have the physical. And the acupuncture needles, obviously, it's a physical treatment. By the time I pick up a needle, I've already connected through the spirit, through the mind, and then the body. And then the three come together. And that is the importance of the interaction, is that you meet the person, you meet as one, you actually engage with them mentally, and then you meet physically. And that's why it's such an unusual experience, because it's, and also it's not by accident. You know, the training is very clear that we have to have what we call rapport with ourselves, first of all, which means that we have to be totally present to ourselves to then invite that person to join us. So, you know, if I'm worrying about their fertility or worrying about their headaches, or even if I'm desiring that they get better, that gets in the way. It's really important to have a really clear differentiation between me, the what we call the instrument in the room, versus me, Jared, hanging out with someone.
Yeah, and I guess so important to not muddy your stuff, just like you're saying, that connection to you and that oneness with you has got to be there. Otherwise, I guess this muddiness can occur where it's not clear whose stuff is what. And that is obviously what you and what you do is you're just amazing at, because everything that you've just said there, I can completely back up. And I feel like when I met you and coming into the chair to have treatment with you, it was that, like that oneness and that spirit that is lacking in other treatments when you're having conversations, talking about what's going wrong or what you perceive to be going wrong. And then the work that you do, it's just, yeah, exactly as you said it. And I can completely back that up. I'd love for you to now just speak a little bit about the physical treatment then. So how does that actually work, and what is that physical treatment like?
So the acupuncture needle is a way for me as the practitioner, as the instrument, to make contact directly with one of the organs. We call in this tradition the officials. So the body is likened to a little kingdom. So it's the microcosm of the macrocosm. And there are 10 organs and 2 functions, and they're likened to the Western idea of the organs. Once you've made your diagnosis of which is the element that's asking for help, you then know which 2 organs you're going to be working with. And the needle is literally a way of communicating with those organs or officials. So if, for example, I've diagnosed that somebody has an underlying weakness within the wood element, I'm then talking about the liver and the gallbladder. And the acupuncture needle pierces the skin and then goes down to the depth where the actual flow of energy that relates to the liver or the gallbladder. The different points have different means of communicating different things to that organ or official. So I'll just give you a very simple example. So the liver, for example, is responsible for the kind of the widespread plan of life. It's how we perceive things, how we look forward, how we feel hopeful, how we take action. It has this very kind of dynamic, forward-looking feeling. If that fails in someone, that sense of hope goes away, and that sense of possibility leaves the person, and they start to feel angry and frustrated and trapped. So the way that we help someone in that situation and help all of the elements is by going to the liver and restoring its natural function. Now, it sounds all a bit kooky when you think about it like that, but the Chinese didn't have a problem with understanding that the totality of us and our emotions are not something we've cooked up in our heads. That this is an expression of the collective responsibility and activity of the internal organs. So when I'm feeling sympathetic for someone, that's coming from the earth element. And if the earth element is working efficiently, then I have a capacity to be sympathetic. And if it doesn't, I lose that capacity. So the emotions are very much tied in with the organs. So sorry, to go back to your question about the physical treatment, it really is about how it's an extension of the interaction. Because you make your diagnosis by interacting with the person, being with the person, and using your senses, and then you literally use the needle to make that contact with the bit that needs the help.
And you use moxa, is that correct?
Yes, moxa is a Chinese herb. It's the mugwort plant, it's the name in the West, or Artemisia. And what the mugwort does, or the moxa, is it warms the point before the needle goes through the skin. And the idea is that when you're working with something that has become deficient or weak, just like in nature, it contracts and becomes smaller. What we want to do is build it up, release it, so that the needle will come in and then move the chi or the energy through the channels and through the whole body, mind, spirit.
And so I kind of found my way to you because you and your clinic are renowned for the work that you do in the fertility world and supporting people through that journey of conception. And Is there a common thread that you see amongst your patients who are struggling to conceive or coming for that kind of thing around fertility? Is there a common thread and a common organ and a common kind of treatment that you're doing, or is it really very individual still?
It's totally individual, and this kind of frustrates people. What people want when they're really desperate for something, particularly with fertility, people want a kind of clear, logical reason why it hasn't happened. So if you could say to them, oh, it's because the kidneys are not working properly, and that's definitely it, you know, then and that would be the same for everyone. You know, it'd be great in one way, but it is a missed opportunity, because getting pregnant or making babies, you know, is a normal, healthy function. It is no different than digesting an apple or breathing in air. You know, if everything's working properly, it will happen in its own right time. This is another thing, you know, it can't be on our schedule. So the treatments are totally individualized, because what we understand is that if there isn't an overall balance within all the elements, within all the organs, then that will affect your fertility in the same way that circulation of blood around the body can be affected by many different things. There isn't just one cause for that. What we're always looking when we're working with people, particularly when they're coming for fertility issues, is that other areas of their life change first. What we want to see is that basic things like sleeping more deeply, feeling more energized, having a better appetite, engaging with work in a healthier way, improving relationships with friends, all of these things tell us that the person is coming back into balance. And then typically, after a period of time, sometimes very quickly, then the person conceives for no apparent reason from a medical point of view. And I think what's also interesting is that the clear majority of people that come to us or attend most IVF clinics have what they call medically undiagnosed infertility, meaning they don't know. So a lot of people, you know, doing IVF now, they're doing it because they've maybe been trying for a year and they're frustrated and they're panicked, and they go down that route hoping that there is some medical problem that's going to be discovered along the way. It's just not the right time. The person, you know, isn't at that point where it's going to happen naturally. But the problem is, you know, people are, well, not a problem, but people are having babies later. People are tired by the time they come to their 30s often. They've been working hard. There are many, many contributing factors for why someone isn't conceiving. And as I say, it's no different than someone not having a bowel movement every day. You know, we think that not getting pregnant is more serious. But if you think about health as a whole, everything should be working. You know, having a poo, making babies, being able to get up in the morning, being able to think clearly, you know, they're all equally valid. We just give it more importance because we want it. We want it now.
Yeah, it's so true. I heard you once talking about how the people that you were treating who were coming in struggling to conceive or who couldn't conceive, they presented very similarly to someone who was going to die or was around someone they loved who was dying. Is that correct?
Yes, it does sound a bit extreme. I mean, the reason that I said that is because when I first came out of acupuncture school, I did voluntary work at King's College Hospital on the AIDS ward. This was in the very early 90s. So I kind of cut my teeth on dying people. So it was quite an extreme way to start working with people. Obviously, I wasn't expecting to save people's lives because they were close to death when I was treating them. But what I was aware of is how you could facilitate a very profound and personal sense of self, even in the face of death, and the kind of peace that comes with that. So because that was my kind of entry-level experience, I could feel the desperation in people. And these were mainly young men and women who were dying. And so suddenly having this new patient load of people trying to get pregnant had a similar kind of feel, the desperation and the loneliness and the feeling of being wrong, different to other people, all the same characteristics of someone young who's dying from a disease like AIDS. So yes, I think it's a very private and a very lonely, desperate experience for people. And it's not the kind of thing that they want to talk widely about. So yes, I think it does feel life and death. And I think particularly because we're hardwired to procreate, that desire to be a parent is not an intellectual thing, it's in us. So I think it's incredibly challenging and brings up huge, huge issues of all kinds for people.
Following on from what you're saying there, we're at like this peak of infertility, right? Like the rates of, I mean, in my friendship groups, it's crazy the amount of people who are seeking IVF and men's sperm health. We hear about all this stuff. Obviously, we live in quite a polluted world in many ways, and what we're thinking, consuming, breathing, all that. Do you have any insight, or do you think it's kind of bred from this, like, I want it and I want it now and there's something wrong with me, so I need to fix it? Or what do you think this rise in IVF is about?
I think it's all of the above, really. There are so many different factors at play. From my experience of working with people and seeing if the outcome or the expected outcome is a pregnancy, I would say that the clearest example for me is a change in the person and how they feel themselves. So I would say it's a spiritual problem more than anything else. I mean, obviously, age is a factor. And there is a certain kind of impatience around it. So a lot of people probably would conceive given time, but it might take 2 to 3 years. But I think if the person is not at peace with themselves, if they're not living in a way that is harmonious and supports the balance that they try to find within themselves, I think, you know, nature doesn't want to burden you with a baby. I mean, it's on a very basic level, cell division, the amount of energy it takes to produce a sperm and an egg is much greater than any other cell in the body. So nature prioritizes the organs that will keep you alive before it's going to start giving that extra bit of energy to procreation. And also, we have to remember that human beings don't get pregnant that easily compared to other animals. There is a difference, the way that we've evolved. And so I think there is something about the evolution of human beings. And we all know that we've gone off track when we look at the environment and we look at mental health issues and we look at the politics and everything around us. You know, we know that as a species, we're not okay. And what people do, I think, is that they try to create their own little micro world and try to make it okay. And part of that is having a family. But what, again, I know from treatment is that what I see when people start to come back into balance, when they feel happier and more peaceful in themselves, they start to engage with the world in a different way. It's that kind of ripple effect. So it's not the kind of answer that people want to hear, really, because we're used to getting the quick fix thing. You know, this is wrong, here's a pill, off you go. But as I say, I think it's an opportunity for all of us. It gets a lot of people into the whole self-help world by accident, almost.
I love what you said there. I mean, it just totally talked to me when you said it's a spiritual problem, and it's really about being in that right place and how you're interacting with the world, how you are going through your life, how your relationships, how's your relationship with yourself. And for me, that was like the pivotal moment, you know, coming to you with desperation, like, save me, help me, like, what can we do? Let's do this together. Please help me. And ultimately feeling quite fine probably about the rest of my life, like, you know, look, Jared, everything's good, like everything's good. But then over the time and over the different experiences that came up, while they were difficult and while it didn't work, it was like, it's hard to say and it could be triggering to say, but thank goodness it didn't work, because it's propelled me in a much deeper, more authentic way to actually, like, I'm grateful because now I am actually where I'm supposed to be and trusting much more deeply in that there's not something wrong with me. And it feels, whether I have a child one day or not, it feels fertile because I've got my vitality. I'm full, I'm quite peaceful, but also energetic, and I'm not worried. And I think you hit the nail on the head for me personally when you just said that. It was like this coming home and this finding myself again and connecting with the world in a deeper way, more presently here and now. Ultimately, child or not, as I said, that's surely more fertile.
Absolutely. I mean, this idea that somehow your life is unfulfilled if you don't have children. A, I don't have children, so I would hate to think that's true. And I have a really good life and I have a wonderful career and friends and I have freedom to do a lot of what I want to do. So I really can't complain. Again, going back, I want to emphasize that, yes, of course, I understand that it's a normal, natural thing to want to have kids, but it isn't the only way to have an amazing life.
Yes.
And when I look at a lot of people that go through this whole process, getting, you know, 1, 2, sometimes 3 children, and then they're still coming back and still not happy. And I know that's kind of really annoying to hear as well, but the human condition is that we always want a bit more. And we always think that happiness is over there. And I think that the family children thing is a bit of an illusion, a bit of a myth. If I can just get this baby, then I'll be happy. And of course, it's not true. They come back for baby number two, and they're even more desperate. So then we have to go through that one. And then still not happy. And what's amazing, and I'm not being critical, because I include myself in this as well. You know, we all want a bit more. This is the spiritual problem. When we have contact with our spirit, i.e. a deep sense of ourself, the craving and the longing and the wanting stops. And then we get to enjoy it if we happen to have kids, and we get to enjoy it if we happen to move somewhere new, or, you know, we start to enjoy the simple things. That's, I mean, the book I wrote, Everything You Need, You Have, when we were trying to work out the title for that, I mean, we're around the houses. It is that basic spiritual message that we're all running around trying to fulfill ourselves, and yet we've all got it right now. And that is a deep sense of our own existence. And that is it. And I know there's so many traditions talk about this, but the mind cannot contemplate that. It doesn't get it. It doesn't get that we're already done, because the mind is binary and it's constantly active and trying to work it out. And one of its stories is, I'll be happy when. I'll be happy if.
Yeah.
And it's driving us all mad.
Mad. So, Jared, as you know, this podcast is all about transforming our wounds into wisdom, and that when we choose to view every experience as inherently useful or something that we can learn and grow from, even the hardest times can become our most transformational and insightful. Was there a specific time in your life that turned out to be the catalyst in propelling you forward on the journey to becoming who you are today?
I would say there have been many. The biggest one was being in San Francisco and giving up what I thought I was going to do. I was very clear in my 20s that I wanted to be a millionaire, basically. I remember thinking, I want to be a millionaire. And I like business. And I was good at it, and I had, you know, great success in San Francisco with my first business there. And then it all went to shit for various reasons, which I won't go into now, but there were lots of very negative factors at that time. So that kind of fall from perceived grace was the big one. I suddenly realized I was not going to be a millionaire. Somehow it didn't quite work for me, that I was lost. I didn't know who I was. It was a crushing disintegration of the idea of who I thought I was and would be. That was the theme then, and that continues to be the theme. I can still feel that, like even with acupuncture, you know, getting some success and getting your face in the paper and things like that, you know, it puffs you up and that old feeling comes up again, and then pretty quickly, poof, get sideswiped. What you're saying there is, you know, that all of it is fascinating if you engage with it fully and learn the lessons from it, and to accept again that there's no end point. I'm not sorted out by any means.
Exactly. And I think that's such a powerful thing to open up to, because I feel that a lot of people look at people like you, like world-renowned healers and different practitioners, and think that they've got it all sorted out. And like you said, it never ends. There's no end point. It's a journey. Life is a journey, and we're always learning, discovering, relearning again. And for people to not just think everyone's got it all figured out, we're all on our own paths.
I'll talk about my own experiences. These two things can do coexist. Meaning, I think that what I have achieved for myself is the penny dropping moment where I kind of got it that I'm okay. I'm okay no matter what, whether I'm feeling great or bad or things are going well or not, I'm permanently okay. I got that about 10 years ago. And as that moment happened, I suddenly saw the chaos of my life, the contradictions of my mind, the insults that I can make, the love and compliments I can give. You know, I suddenly realized there's room for everything. Mm. And you get to be the messy human being and the person that's having a human experience.
Yeah.
The tradition that I'm practicing in, you know, it supports this idea that we're spiritual beings having a human experience. Now, that completely makes sense. When the penny drop moment happened, I thought, okay, I get it. We're essentially spirit, but we're having this human experience. And that is full of light and dark. Mm. And we shouldn't shy away or be attracted particularly to either one or the other. That's the nature of life. There's night and there's day. But what gives us the anchor and the capacity to withstand the complexity of life is that sense of self, which is what we're calling the spirit, but a deep sense of self that all of us, that we're all okay permanently.
And that just basically, you've answered my next question, was exactly that. Like, life can be so challenging. Everything you're talking about there with the mental busyness, is there a practice that you have to stay grateful even in the dark times? But I feel like you've just answered it there. But is there anything else that you want to add to that?
The way that I stay in that place is by being a practitioner. That's why I love my work so much selfishly, because when I walk into the treatment room, I inhabit that part of myself because I have to be in that space to help other people. It goes back to what I was saying earlier, that I can't invite someone to join me in peace if I'm not genuinely sitting in peace. So if I'm going to do this job properly, I have to consciously go into that place. It's a form of meditation. So all day long, I am sitting in peace, you know, that part of me that doesn't make any judgments, that doesn't have any expectations, that is just is. That is my practice. I think when I'm not working, when I'm away, I struggle. I can feel myself spinning off into my mind and questioning things and longing for things or rejecting things. That's where I say I'm not sorted. But my work, it gives me that wonderful dual perspective. But I mean, I think a lot of people have that in different ways in their life. Maybe they don't realize it. Things that they love, you know. There are things that we do that we love. And I think we love it because we inhabit that part of ourselves.
Yeah, we were just speaking about this last night, actually, me and my husband, and just, you know, what is spirit or what is God? And basically, it's all wrapped up in language. We're all trying to figure out what this thing is. But ultimately, it comes to that, what you're just saying, this maybe when we're in church singing or we're in a yoga class or we're connecting with friends or nature, that what you're just saying that you feel when you're practicing, when you're treating, that's it, isn't it? And if we can all tap into that, that what we love and what brings us this oneness, this peace, this back to self, that's it, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. And I mean, love is the key word here, which of course is a bit skewed because we always think of it as romantic love. But the concept of love is just another word for the self. And when I say to people in the treatment room, because for example, going back to the fertility patients, if I say, okay, so let's put the baby thing aside for a moment. Tell me what you'd really love for yourself. People really struggle to come up with an answer because they've put this whole thing about what they'd love onto this one thing. Mm. And it's really hard. You can see that the mind's kind of taken over and it's said to the person, if I can get this, then I'll be okay. So I'm repeating myself there. But I think, you know, to ask that question is difficult. You know, what do you love to do? Where do you love to be? I know I love treating. I was living in the south of France, living the dream, but I missed my work. I mean, I was coming back regularly, but I thought I'd rather spend 80% of my time working than sitting by a pool. But I didn't know that 10 years ago. I'm back in London where I don't really want to be, but I love my work. So that's on balance, that's more important. For now, that may change, of course. Mm. And I love teaching too, so.
I think you've just, again, answered my next question, which was, how do we begin the journey home to self? How do we start, Jared? You're so far on your path. Someone's listening to this and they're really in the darkest time, confused, really not sure which way to go. The most basic thing, where can someone start to journey home to even begin to think, what is it that I love? You know?
Well, I think it's to differentiate between thinking and feeling. The human mind is an incredible thing, but it is a thing. It is a mechanism that gives us the capacity to label things and to create language and create form. I mean, it's incredible, but it is only one part of us. And I think that when we get lost in our mind and our projections and our hopes and expectations, the story of me, where I come from, where I want to get to, you know, it becomes this trap in a way. And I think that's when we lose the connection with what we love. When we're talking about love, we're talking about from the heart, you know, what touches us. For people listening, I think it really is about coming back to your senses, you talked about going out and being in nature. The reason we like being in nature is because we're in an environment that's balanced and it is stuffed full of sensory stimulus. So we're smelling things and we're hearing things and we're feeling things, and you feel, you know, it all sounds very hippie, but you know, the wind on your face and you feel the water. But what that's doing is it's directing your attention back to what's real. You know, the mind isn't real, it's a construct, and it's a unique construct. We all have our own thoughts about things, and no two people think the same way. Whereas when we come back to senses, we are the same. So you and I will smell a banana and we smell a banana. Now, we could then talk about it in a different way, but that's the mind coming in and complicating it. So if you want to come back to yourself, start engaging with the world through your senses. You know, really sit and listen. And it doesn't matter. It could be cars going by. It doesn't have to be birds tweeting. But activate your senses. You know, really start looking at people. Really look at them. Look at people in the eyes. And touch everything and feel everything. And that, as soon as you do that, your attention has to go back to the sensory part of yourself, which is real.
Such a brilliant tool to give to remind people. Just so simple, coming back to the senses, and so profound.
Yeah.
So, Jared, thank you so much for our little conversation. Please share with our listeners where they can connect with you. Where can they find you?
Best thing is to go through the website, which is jaredkite.com. People always get my name wrong. It's G-E-R-A-D, no extra R. So jaredkite, K-I-T-E.com. And if anyone's interested in studying, which of course I'm trying to convert everyone into acupuncturists to save the world.
I want to do it.
Great. It's all there online. It's yellowpath.com.
And actually, Jared, you have some free little videos that I found online, and I actually subscribed to your website at one point and did some of the intro videos around like the basic elements and all of that. And it's so insightful. And even those intro videos are really, really juicy and full of information and wisdom. So I can definitely recommend that you go there. So thank you, Jared. Thank you for joining us on The Alchemy of Life. And thanks everyone for listening. We're a new podcast, as you know. So every single listen, 5-star rating and share goes a really long way. Thanks for all your support, and see you next time on The Alchemy of Life podcast.